they actually build systems that have state machines and try to model like the five most common alternate responses, and so they try to make the machines emulate what humans do, but it's, you know, we have a long way to go. But the interesting thing about the Google application, which sort of is relevant to the lecture today, is they're going to be able to collect so much data with this application. Because any of these applications, the way they're doing it as a client server, so the data is being shipped to their servers already. If it was just an iPhone application, you'd still have data collection problems. But because it's a client server application, they sit back on the servers and they just collect all the data. And I think that, and then using the unsupervised training techniques we're going to talk about today, they should be able to improve the system dramatically. On the other hand, the real problem with that application is that most speech recognition systems work on the principle of they can recognize the most common words. And internet searching is tough because the words you're searching for are, by definition, uncommon words. And the uncommon words, what we call the information bearing words or words with high information content, you know, those are the ones that are most important to you. When you say, show me all the web pages that have show me all the web pages about some particular product. Like you might say, my laptop. Like I have a Toshiba Satellite 5421. You know, show me the user's manual. Well, all that less common information is what's really important to that query. The show me and all the others, it's just general. So people for a long time have thought search is not going to be a good application for voice recognition because you have to have a very, very large vocabulary, a very, very large language model. Now, I think Google's going to try to exploit the fact that a lot of people do searches on basic things like sports and news, but even so, the main thing that they're offering people is the ability to search from their phones without using a keyboard. So there's a convenience feature. But you can't really do, you wouldn't want to try to do like you were searching for the paper.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to try to do that by voice because all the important words you were speaking would be misrecognized. So let's go ahead and get started. But this is a good discussion. We were just discussing a little bit about the Google iPhone and the Google app on iPhone and some of its shortcomings. What I want to talk about today is a topic related to that, really, which is this issue of unsupervised versus supervised adaptation. The work that I'm going to talk about today is some work published by a couple of BBN researchers, Jeff Ma and Richard Schwartz. This is a paper called Unsupervised versus Supervised Training of Acoustic Models. It just appeared in one of our major conferences in September. I had a chance to review this paper for the conference, so I got to see it a few months before it came out. And at the time, it was very clear it was some interesting work. I want to put the usual disclaimer in that though this work is focused on speech recognition, the conclusions drawn, I believe, are applicable to almost any real-world adaptation problem that involves a large, complex system. So what I mean by that is, the bulk of the research literature that I see in many fields is published on very small amounts of data. What I've always enjoyed about speech recognition is we've always been pushing the limit of the amount of data. So today we're going to talk about databases that consist of 2,000 hours of transcribed data. That's probably the largest such database ever assembled. And within the field now, we're beginning to work on 10,000 hour database, and there's been planning going on for 1 million hours worth of data. So why do you need this kind of data? Well, we were talking before class about language problems are always interesting because there's many dialects, many different types of speakers. So even with 2,000 hours of data, I think with the data, the 2,000 hours that they have, I think that comprises several thousand speakers, if I remember right, or maybe 10,000 speakers even, but that's still fairly small when you think about the fact that there's, even if you talk about a language like English, there are probably 10 to 15 major accents or dialects of English. And then if you look at all the other non-native speakers who try to speak English, and you look at all the dialects within the U.S. Of English, you need thousands and thousands of speakers to get good representations for the database. So if you're working a problem, and I think some problems lend itself to this, I don't think speech is unique to these kinds of problems. It just happens to be one area where we've had the financing and the interest in collecting these large databases. And because of that, we're able to do some very interesting experiments about what happens when you do a little bit of supervised training and lots of unsupervised training versus fully supervised training. And because the real question that's trying to be asked here is, how far can we go using unsupervised adaptation on very large amounts of data? And the contribution of the paper is to show that, in fact, it appears as though we can go ahead and continue this paradigm of iterating in an unsupervised adaptation on large amounts of data. Now, that's pretty profound, because in the past we focused our efforts on trying to collect and transcribe data. And this has been a major paradigm shift for the community. It relates to a general shift in most fields where we're trying to increasingly use what's called found data, data that's not been developed for your particular application, but data that's useful to your application. A good example of this within natural language processing are resources like Wikipedia. Can you mine resources like Wikipedia to build knowledge bases to help you do knowledge-driven approaches in research like natural language processing, even though that data was originally created for a completely different purpose? Well, the same thing is true with the audio data. Can you, for example, collect all the audio data from YouTube and use that to train your models? This is free data. If you can get hold of this data for free. And even if the key thing about the paper today is that even if the data is less perfect, if you will, than the manually transcribed data, there's so much more of it that even if you get some small delta improvement in performance, because you have access to unlimited amounts of this data, you can build very large databases very quickly, and you can eventually exceed performance of what you can achieve using the high-performance manually transcribed data. So I hope people can appreciate that point, that even though you get just a little bit of improvement with this data, there's so much of it that you can still eventually exceed performance you can get by other mechanisms. And that's really what the paper is trying to show. And because of that, we're now looking at applications like the Google Phone. The Google Phone, in a matter of weeks, is going to collect more data than we've probably collected previously in all speech recognition applications, because it will have millions of users. So a little bit of historical perspective on what got us to this point. And I think this is important for you as graduate students in particular to appreciate, because many of you are probably still working on along the lines of small amounts of data collected under controlled conditions. So we began many, many years ago, this goes back to probably the late 1960s, early 70s, with small amounts of data collected under controlled conditions. Users were prompted with the text to be spoken, and an operator sat there and verified the contents. Operator listened after they spoke and said, yes, keep it, no, speak it again. We built a number of important databases that way even through the early 1980s, we were doing a lot of data collection that way. This data was easy to use because users were prompted what to speak, so we knew we had the reference transcriptions. There was no need to transcribe the data. But collection of the data was very time-consuming because you could typically only get a person to speak for maybe 45 minutes to an hour before they'd get really tired. So you could only collect a few hundred hours of data, with that kind of an approach. But what this allowed us to do then is to take this kind of data, knowing what words were spoken, and we would then build hidden Markov models in an automated way from this data. Now, one of the interesting things about that approach is that the hidden Markov models were built in terms of subunits, particularly phonemes. But we didn't need to know what exact phonemes were spoken. We could actually infer that using the hidden Markov modeling training paradigm, where we are able to essentially use an ML-type approach to estimate the internal states. So we would actually seed the models with random values, just literally random number values, and we would just use the word-level transcription, and all the rest of the training was fully automated. And after three passes of that kind of training on fully supervised data, we were able to get phone models which gave pretty good performance. So in those days, error rates, you know, people would like to point out that error rates were on the order of 1% and such. But that approach suffered from two fatal flaws. One was the amount of data was small, so if you had a speaker from a different dialect or a speaker who was significantly different than your training speaker's, performance on that speaker would not be good. I was telling the students in class earlier that when I first came to Mississippi State, the Deep South dialect here in Mississippi was very poorly represented with most of the commercial technology that was out there. So I don't know if you ever bought a copy of Dragon Dictate or IBM Naturally Speaking or some of these products. Early 1990s, like 94 when I joined Mississippi State, these products were not doing very well on Mississippi dialects. So one of our first activities was to collect some of that kind of data for the community because we had access to the dialects down here. Yeah, there's another point I was going to make about that, but I've forgotten. But so and then the other problem with that approach was when you would take those models trained under controlled conditions and you try to apply them to a completely different application space, they wouldn't work well. So again, we were talking about the Google iPhone. The style of speech for these kinds of queries from your iPhone is much different than the style of speech from, for example, the way two people would talk to each other over the telephone. So Google's had to do a little bit of adaptation to make that system focused more on that kind of speech, and they're going to continue to do that kind of adaptation. Well, typically, when we would work with this controlled data, when we would change from one domain to the other, performance would become very, very bad. Typically, error rates would rise at least an order of magnitude, if not two orders of magnitude. So you could go from 1% error rate to 100% error rate, or 1% error rate to 50% error rate. So that was a bad thing. So then we transitioned to spontaneous telephone conversations, but now you had no control over what the people were saying, so that in turn created the problem that you had to manually transcribe the data. Real-time rates for transcription were often 100 times real-time, meaning it would take you 100 seconds to transcribe 1 second of speech. So, and that also cost you, if a transcriber, you know, was costing you about $10 an hour or $20 an hour, the data was actually costing us on the order of $100 to $1,000 per minute of speech, and therefore collecting 2,000 hours or 10,000 hours of speech under this paradigm was not really feasible. An equally serious problem was that the transcriptions generated by humans were maybe between 1 and 10% error. And that's a problem because, if you remember, discriminative training is going to try to minimize error rate. So discriminative training can really lock into these transcription errors and can really do some damage because they think these transcription errors are correct and they're really anomalous. So this took us, but through probably the 1990s, we were still doing a lot of this kind of data collection. But then we began investigating what's called found data. And the most prominent source of this was data from news broadcasts that had been transcribed with the closed captioning. Now, this was a very interesting activity, because closed captioning is not a word-by-word transcription of what was spoken. It's what's called an approximate transcription. It tries to get the information content, but it doesn't model the speech word per word. So people experimented with whether we could use this data, and they tended to find that you could get some benefit from the data, but the benefit per unit of data was much less than the fully transcribed data because of the inaccuracies of the transcriptions. But nevertheless, again, you had more access to more of this data, so you would hope that by making it, having access to a larger volume of data, you could ultimately get better performance with your recognition system. Well, this kind of took them, gave some benefit, but did not really, it did not scale up as was hoped. So then we sort of went back to, well, how can we improve the transcription process? And a process was developed called fast transcription, which allowed us to transcribe data at rates on the order of about 7 times real time. And so it was significantly faster than the early days, but the transcriptions were also not precise. They were, again, approximate. And with this fast transcription technique, we were able to generate a 2,000-hour database, which is the database we're going to talk about today. And so that's a database which you can consider to be transcribed, but not perfectly transcribed. And that's the data that's going to form the basis for our experiments comparing supervised and unsupervised transcription. Now, it's not fully supervised because these transcriptions are somewhat inaccurate, but they're pretty good in terms of accuracy. I believe error rates are on the order of a few percent, on the range of about 5%. But what the real goal of this paper is to ask the question, can we actually just use the untranscribed data to adapt the system? Now, the system we're going to be talking about is a speech recognition system, which consists of two components, essentially, a language model and an acoustic model. The acoustic model represents the Gaussian mixture distributions that we've been talking about. It models the feature vectors, you could say the acoustic environments. The language model models what words were spoken. We're not going to talk about adaptation of the language model today. We're going to focus mainly on the acoustic model. And it's important to understand this distinction, because these unsupervised techniques tend to work very well for the acoustic data, but they don't completely solve the problem, because you need supervised data to do the language model transcription. Now, the nice thing about that is that we can use data from other sources to do the language model transcription, because the language model really just reflects basic knowledge of the language, what words can follow what other words. And for that data, you can go to alternate sources like the internet to pull down large amounts of text data. So the language model training problem doesn't require this kind of a scenario, and we've been able to train language models on billions and billions of words of text. Google, for example, has trained language models across all the web pages that are indexed in their system, which amounts to, you know, billions of web pages and terabytes worth of words. But we're going to talk primarily about the acoustic model adaptation, and it's reasonable to think you might be able to get some mileage on that using unsupervised data. Okay, so now I'm just going to sort of go through the paper, and I've tried to highlight some of the key points. And the paper's, I think, fairly easy to read. Oh, I wanted to mention, in case this isn't obvious, again, I want to point out that these links under resources actually have links to the paper. So this is a link to the paper that we're talking about today. And these pictures are also linked to some resources that I think you'll find, hopefully you'll find interesting, that are relevant to the course. So you do have access. There's actually a number of good links on the course, on the lecture webpage, front, the title page of the lecture. So let's go through this paper today. The abstract of the paper. In the abstract, they report on unsupervised training experiments on large amounts of data, and by that they mean 2,000 hours of the English Fisher Conversational Telephone Speech Database. This was a database collected by the National Institute for Standards and Technology, NIST, and it was also collected in conjunction with an organization called Linguistic Data Consortium, which provides our community with these kinds of resources. This took a couple of years to collect this data. 2,000 hours is about 57 gigabytes of audio data. So that sort of gives you some handle on how much processing is required. We talked about the problem of generating lattices. And as this intermediate representation, for example, so if you think about this, if you have 57 gigabytes of data and you're generating lattices, which might require a factor of 10 or a factor of 100 additional disk space over your original space, so if you have one byte of audio data, it may take 10 or 100 bytes of audio data to store the lattice, you can see where you start to run into problems. If you multiply this number by 100, you're hitting the terabyte range just to store the intermediate data. So we spend a lot of time in this kind of research pushing the limits of our computing systems, trying to figure out ways we can compress information, because when you have this large amounts of data, every little bit of data you have to store to do your experiments becomes significant. So it's not uncommon that if you're going to try to process this kind of data, you're talking about needing terabytes of disk space, which actually, you know, when I started in this field was a big deal, but I was at the store a few weeks ago, and you can buy a 1 terabyte disk for $200 now, $150. I mean, it's really unbelievable how much disk space has gone down in cost. So that's actually not, you know, that all this is within, is feasible with off-the-shelf computing. So the major contribution of the paper is to compare behaviors of unsupervised training with supervised training on exactly the same data. And to do that, you need access to a large amount of supervised data, and that's really what makes this resource somewhat novel, is the fact that we've got 2,000 hours of manually transcribed data. The main results of the paper are that as the amount of training data increases, unsupervised training, even bootstrapped from a very limited amount of data, improves recognition performance faster than supervised training does, and it converges to supervised training. So this simply means that you continue, by adding all of this 2,000 hours of data, we continue to see improvements in performance using unsupervised training. Therefore, it will be possible to continue improvement of the recognition system beyond the 2,000 hours, and that's essentially why we're looking at trying to collect 10,000 hour and million hour corpuses now, because the idea is that we are getting some improvement from unsupervised training, and we can just hopefully continue that by collecting large amounts of data. Whereas to transcribe 10,000 hours of data or 1 million hours of data, to manually transcribe that amount of data is just not feasible. Another interesting result is that bootstrapping unsupervised training with more manual data is not of significance if a large amount of untranscribed data is available. We'll see this in one of the last tables in the paper. If the benefit of having transcribed data to seed your models diminishes with the more and more amount of untranscribed data you have access to. So that again is a good news story, because it means you can actually seed the system from about 1 hour of manually transcribed data and then just let it run on, you know, thousands of hours of untranscribed data. Now, this is directed more to the students in class here, but I'm guessing most of you have not ever run on databases this size on your applications. I mean, most of the work I've seen at Mississippi State has tended to be on kind of small resources, but are there, are you looking at applications where you have the access to this amount of volume of data? Nobody's. So, because I know some of the groups are actually doing things like spooling satellite data in real time and things like that. A lot of this got started years ago when we started to spool the news services in real time, actually collecting CNN and a few others. And there are companies, government agencies, and a mixture of such that actually spool all the major news services from around the world these days. That's been one of the interesting things about how much easier it's become to collect foreign data. As CNN-type services have popped up around the world, these become excellent ways to collect lots of data in those languages. So we were very happy in the United States when CNN China, which I can't remember what the name of that is, but it's now broadcast in the U.S. and you can connect into this and get, you know, large amounts of good data for training Chinese speech recognition systems and things like that. So CNN's actually been a really interesting phenomenon because it's created news services in different languages that we can get access to, so we can actually compare performance across languages in similar domains. So the next slide I'll talk about, the paper has a nice introduction actually on some of the previous work that's been done with supervision. So though a great amount of work has been reported on unsupervised training, no work has been reported to rigorously compare behaviors of unsupervised and supervised training on such large amounts of data. So again, that's sort of the key contribution here. This is one of the first papers dealing with the entire 2,000-hour data set. Previous work reports unsupervised training experiments on 153 hours of broadcast news data. And this was data collected using the closed captioning approach. So it's these approximate transcriptions, they're not exact transcriptions. And this work considered a variety of conditions, such as bootstrapping the models with as little as 10 minutes of manual data, and also using a small language model trained on only about 1.8 million words. It's more common today to bootstrap systems on several hours of data or several hundred hours of data and to use billions of words to train the language models. So this is considered small bootstrapping. And then what they showed was that even with this small amount of data, unsupervised training was able to decrease the error rate from 60%, 65% to 37% using the 153 hours of unsupervised data. And they showed that this performance was comparable to after adapting on the 153 hours, they showed that this performance was comparable to that which would be achieved using a supervised training on 126 hours of data. Again, where the supervision consisted of these imperfect transcriptions. So this was a bit of work that served as motivation to collect the larger data, because it seemed to indicate, because it didn't really answer the question, what happens when we go beyond the 153 hours? Can we continue to get improvements with the data as we increase that by an order of magnitude? In the past, we've tended to find that even though you get these promising initial results, as you add more data, the benefits become less and less. So another interesting thing about this paper that I'll spend some time on today is to show you that how we have to be very careful about training on large amounts of data. We don't just throw all the data into a big pot and iterate on it. We actually do a bootstrapping approach to build up to training across the large data sets. Previous work was also performed on very large amounts of English and Arabic broadcast news. But the experiments began with 140 hours of well-transcribed data for both languages. And what we'd like to do, it takes creating 100 hours of transcribed data takes often at least a year to do, if not longer. And if you think about the fact that we would like to be able to build recognizers in many languages, some of these languages being very uncommon languages, it's very hard to collect the data, it's very hard to get it transcribed, and it's very time consuming. So that becomes a major barrier towards generating this kind of technology in multiple languages. Now, one of the neat things about Google, if you notice, Google actually supports a pretty wide range of languages in their interface. I think they're up to about supporting 80 languages. And Google has also been heavily working in the area of machine translation and trying to build statistical machine translation systems in other languages using completely automated training techniques. So this is completely automated training techniques are important because you can't simply go and transcribe data in 100 different languages. And typically, if you want to field a multilingual service today and cover most of the major markets in the world, you know, there's about 15 to 20 languages which are sort of dominant from an economic perspective. There's probably 100 languages which are sort of dominant from an operational perspective, and there's about 6,000 total languages in the world. So, you know, you can get the 20 for some amount of money, you can get the 100 for some amount of money, but the 6,000 you'll probably never get. Because some of these languages are not even written, some of these languages there's only a few speakers left and very obscure. But what in some application spaces, like one that I've worked in, when a crisis in the world happens, it happens to, these days, it is often in a language we've never heard about before. Some American tourists were abducted in the Philippines several years ago for the first time. They were abducted by terrorists who spoke a dialect that most of us in the U.S. didn't even know existed. And what do you do in a case like that? You've got to find some people who know that dialect so you can communicate with these people, and it creates really serious problems. So even though there's only about 20 languages that are of economic importance, if you really want a situational awareness of the entire world, you need to have much more capability than that. And okay, so we'll now go ahead and talk about let me go back. Okay, I remember now what that other point was. So on this this data where we had 140 hours of transcribed data, this was broadcast news data, so they had access to the closed caption transcriptions. And so on that data, they were able to show that unsupervised training produced some improvement in performance when training across 2,000 hours of data, but they didn't have the 2,000 hours of data transcribed in a reasonably accurate way. The closed captioning is an approximate transcription and has some problems associated with it. So there were still some questions about would this result hold for much larger data that was actually transcribed. So the unsupervised training was compared to lightly supervised training, which was designed to take advantage of the availability of closed captions. And the results on that were mixed. So there were a lot of questions about whether we could do better than this closed caption data. And the unsupervised training produced only slightly worse performance than the lightly supervised training, 13.7% word error rate to 13.2. Now, when people got that result, they said, well, that doesn't seem to be so significant because the lightly supervised data, the closed captioning information, exists. We can get that for free. So why don't I just use that if I can get good performance? So people weren't too excited about this result, but what was being masked in this result was the fact that the closed captioning data, you can only go so far with training on that, because the closed captions are really very rough transcriptions of the data, and that becomes a barrier at some point. So in this paper, we're going to focus on the comparisons between unsupervised and supervised training. And then the other issue that's of interest is how much transcribed data do we need to seed or to bootstrap the system. And then in addition to those things, we're also working in this work, they're focusing on conversational telephone speech, which is more casual and much harder than broadcast news, where people tend to speak in a more careful, controlled manner because it's a newscast and they would like they'd like listeners to be able to understand them. With conversational speech, you use a much more casual style, you use a more colloquial jargon, and all these kinds of issues. So the prior work was extended in two ways. Showing these improvements on conversational telephone speech and showing that the results scale up to these 2,000 hours of data. So the data itself, we mentioned briefly, consists of 2,300 hours of telephone conversational speech. All the data was transcribed using a fast transcription technique, which is a situation where transcribers you run the data through a recognizer, they give you an approximate transcription, and then you go in and try to quickly correct that for major errors. That process runs about 5 to 7 times real time for English, and it gives you an error rate of between about 1% and 5% at the word level. There were two scenarios examined, one where we seed or bootstrap the models with 1 hour of fully carefully transcribed data, 1 hour of accurately transcribed data, and 10 hours of accurately transcribed data. And again, that's important because generating 1 hour of training data in a new language is not so bad. Generating 10 hours of training data in a new language, you know, it's 10 times harder. And the first time you go into a new language and start transcribing data, it's pretty expensive because it takes a while to figure out how the data should be transcribed. So the cost of generating 10 hours of manual data, you're probably talking about $500,000 to be able to generate that. And that's a little bit much if you're trying to serve 100 languages. So then taking this seeding data, we're then going to look at performance on three subsets, 32 hours, 200 hours, and 2,000 hours. And one nice thing that was done here, and we typically do in these kinds of experiments, we make sure that the data sets are subsets of one another. So the 1 hour is a subset of the 10 hours, the 10 hours is a subset of the 32 hours, and so forth. That generally is a good idea because it will give you fairly smooth performance estimates. And then another thing that was done, which is nice, was to evaluate the results on two evaluation sets. One is a set of data that was reserved from the original 2,300 hours of data. We call that the development test set. It's data like the training data, but it's from a different data collection. So it's somewhat disjoint from the data. And then the other thing was a evaluation set. This is a blind evaluation set, which was completely disjoint from the original data collection. So performance is shown on both of these as a way of showing that the trends are very real because they hold up across two different independently collected data sets. Now, we won't talk about the language modeling aspect of this problem, but the language model was trained on 1 billion words taken from a completely different domain. So some effort was spent to get a good language model in place. And language models are important in speech recognition. In fact, when you talk about going from an application like the Google searching to the voice response systems on a telephone that we were talking about, the primary difference between those two applications is not the acoustic data, but the actual language modeling data. So adaption of the language model is something I'll touch on next class, but for this study, we just kept the language model was kept fixed. Now, two performance measures were used to evaluate this, and I thought this was kind of an interesting part of the work. The first measure is what's called word error rate recovery against supervised training. And what this means is it's the absolute word error rate reduction that you achieve on the unsupervised training divided by the absolute reduction that supervised training provides. So the upper bound for unsupervised training would be the performance of supervised training, and that would be a word error rate recovery of 100%. So what this is saying is, if I give you a set of data, like these 2,000 hours of data, the best you could expect to do on that data is a word error rate that would result from training using the transcriptions, fully supervised training. So if we call that performance X, then when we look at different ways to do unsupervised training, we would expect to do for the error rates on the unsupervised training, we would expect the error rates to be worse on the unsupervised training. So we'll take the total possible reduction in error rate from our baseline system to our fully supervised system, and then we'll look at how much of that we can recover by using additional unsupervised training. So that's one measure that's used, and that's quoted in terms of percentage. The second measure is a word error rate ratio, and this is the ratio of the word error rate on unsupervised training to the word error rate on supervised training, and this is a ratio which you would expect to approach 1. It'll be greater than 1, though, because the word error rate on unsupervised training is going to be much higher than the word error rate on supervised training. So the goal of this metric would be to drive it to 1, but we would expect this measure to be greater than 1. And one of the interesting things about this work is with respect to this second measure, they actually show that this ratio stays relatively constant as you're scaling up the data. And that's actually a good thing, because that says you're still learning new things from the new data. It's not like as you add more data, the system's becoming less effective. So we'll see this measure, both these measures, in the final table today, and they produce some interesting analysis. So now what we'll do is we'll go through a series of about 5 experiments where they explore all the different dimensions of this supervised training and unsupervised training. So the first set of experiments deals with establishing essentially the baseline results using supervised training. And these are the results. This is sort of as good as you could expect to do. So the models were trained on these 5 different conditions: 1 hour, 10 hours, 32 hours, 200 hours, and 2,000 hours. No discriminative training was used. And here we, in the table, we show performance as a function of the number of hours of training data. And we show that performance with 2 different language models and on these 2 different evaluation sets. So the key thing here is to note that the overall best numbers that we get on, for example, the DEV04 is this 20.7 in the lower right of the table. That's what happens when you train using all of the 2,000 hours for which you have transcriptions. Okay, so that's one number that you want to keep in mind, because that's the best we could do using 2,000 hours of supervised data. And another number that we want to keep in mind is this line with the 10 hours of manually transcribed data. because this is this 36.3 with the say in the second column the word error rates with LM10, because this is essentially going to be our starting point. And then similarly, we're going to use as a starting point this 1 hour of data is 51.2. So the 51.2 is what you get with 1 hour of supervised training. The 36.3 is essentially what you get with 10 hours of supervised training. And the 20.7 is what you get with 2,000 hours of supervised training. So now the question, so you tell me, what is the question that we're trying to address in the study in the context of this table? So this table outlines the kind of the dimensions of the problem. Now what are we trying to achieve with the work presented in this paper with respect to this table? What are our goals in terms of performance and how we want to achieve that performance? What is the research question that we're trying to answer?
Unsupervised result close to the supervised.
Right. So we want to take this system, for example, this 51.2, and we would like to train in an unsupervised fashion and get as close to this 21.0 as we can. Okay, so that, you know, it's pretty clear, pretty easy, pretty straightforward, but it's an important problem. Okay, is that everyone? Either it's clear or you're bored, one of the two. Well, let me actually go back to that previous slide. Things are never easy in the area like speech recognition. So when we try to go from 1 hour of supervised data to 2,000 hours of unsupervised data, life would be nice if we could just throw the 2,000 hours into the computer and let it crunch on that. But it turns out if you do that, you're not going to get performance that is as good as if you carefully introduce this data bit by bit. So we have to explore what's the best way to actually add this unsupervised data. An interesting set of experiments was done here. They used the 32-hour audio data just because they needed faster turnaround time on the experiments. There are different ways to add new data to unsupervised training. One common approach, the amount of new data added was close to being doubled at each time. This is called a doubling strategy, and it seems to be a good rule of thumb that instead of trying to train on all of the data all at once, you double the amount of data, train, double the amount of data again, train, double the amount of data again, and train. The doubling strategy is to double the amount of data each iteration, use the model from the first hour to recognize the second hour. Remember also that I didn't really discuss the details of the systems here, but we're doing this kind of supervised adaptation where we take the recognizer, recognize the data, and then use that transcription to do the adaptation. So at each stage of this process, we're using the output of the recognizer to guide the adaptation. In the doubling strategy, we use the first hour to recognize the second hour. Then we take those 2 hours, recognize the 4 hours, and so forth. So we basically build up by a factor of two. The use all data strategy is to use just all available data at each iteration. Just simply throw all the data into a big pot, train on it, recognize with it, adapt, and then repeat that process. That's what we've essentially discussed in class when we derived many of these adaptation strategies. We didn't really talk about these incremental training strategies until now. So, for example, the label 1 plus 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 8 just describes the way the data was doubled to get to the final state. And the label 1 plus 31 simply indicates throwing all the data into one iteration. So with table 2, we have performance on this 32-hour subset as a function of the amount of training data. And again, let me say, the reason this was explored is because when we first started bringing these large databases online, when we went from 60 hours of data to 200 hours of data, we actually, the very initial experiments found that training on 200 hours of data was giving worse performance than 60 hours of data. And it took us a couple years to figure all that out, but eventually people figured out ways to increase the amount of data in a controlled manner to give better performance. So you'll see here that the doubling strategy gives an error rate of 41.6. On this particular data, the throwing all the data into one pot and iterating actually gave slightly better performance. So data doubling performed slightly better on the first iteration, but worse on the second iteration. What they actually ended up using was a combination of the two. These particular researchers have developed a way of selecting a subset of the data that seems to be the best chunk of the data for training. So they actually have a use-all selected data strategy where they take this 31 hours and they reduce it to the 25 hours that's the most significant or the most important data. One of the reasons this is done is to try to automatically detect data that's been mistranscribed and throw it away. So this is sort of a culling technique that tries to throw away some of the outliers that you think are really not contributing to the training process. And by doing that, they were actually able to get their best overall number. But fortunately, they found in this that really there's not a whole lot of difference between the doubling strategy and the using all strategy. So that was encouraging. So we can look at, for example, on this 32-hour subset, we can look at our performance measures. The word error rate recovery, we can look at that as 51% was our baseline system trained on 1 hour of data. 38.7 was our best number using the unsupervised training on the 32 hours of data. And we can divide that by the difference between the 51 and 30. 30 was the number we got for fully supervised training. So this ratio, this percentage is 59%. That's the amount of potential performance improvement we were able to recover by using this unsupervised training on the 32 hours of data. So that's 59% of what could have been achieved if we used totally supervised training. And the word error ratio for that was 1.28. And this number is actually going to come back. We're going to see this again, which is kind of an interesting result from this experiment. Now, so you've demonstrated this result on 32 hours of data. What's the next research question that you would like to ask? So you were able to get some improvement by seeding a system with 1 hour of manually transcribed data, training with 32 hours of untranscribed data. So what's the next step? And in doing that, we got this 59% word error rate recovery, which is not bad. Now, you could view this as a success or you could view this as a failure. You could view this as a failure by saying, well, this approach only got 59% of the way there. But why is this a success? And why does this merit continuing this study? Should we wake up our distance learners? So is this 59%, to our guys out of Radiance, is this 59% a success or a failure? Ah, there they are, waking up. Good morning. Do they have audio? They're muted?
They should have audio.
All right, it looks like we have the muting problem again. So just raise your thumbs up if it's a success or thumbs down. Okay, so they must be smart. So why is this a success? Why does this lead you to want to do further research on this topic? So explain to me again what this number represents. So we start with a system that was trained on 1 hour of fully supervised data, right? We introduce 32 hours of untranscribed data. We drop the error rate from 51% to 38%. We could have dropped the error rate more if we had 32 hours of fully transcribed data. If we had 32 hours of fully transcribed data, we would have gotten an error rate of 30%. So by using 32 hours of unsupervised data, we got a significant improvement in performance. We got 60% of the way to the final goal, the best we could ever expect to do. 60% of the way there, that's not bad. Considering this is untranscribed data. And if you're a good engineer, particularly a good speech research engineer or speech researcher, once you get a result like this, what is the obvious thing to do? The obvious thing to do, and this is a principle that I also want you to understand as graduate students, whenever you show me a table where your numbers are getting better, I don't care what you're showing me. As a faculty committee member, I will ask the obvious question, why did you stop? The only time you stop is when the numbers start to get worse, right? So let me go to the pad and show you this. It's an obvious point, but it's something that over the years is really... I did this before where I was able to write on the slide.
Which what color up top that you want to use?
That's right.
And then start writing.
Thank you.
There you go.
So I've you know, over the years attended many, it's another one of these common graduate student mistakes, but you'll see a student present a plot like this. And the reality is they probably stopped there because that's all the data they had or something. But, you know, the question is, why did you stop? The only way you stop when you observe this kind of behavior, right? And then you establish this point as your operating point. Because who knows, maybe you could drive the error rate to zero here by just continuing. And this is sort of a basic principle in speech research. If something works, do more of it. and it'll work more, and keep doing it until it starts getting bad. So this is how we've generated a lot of techniques where we might use, let's say, a fifth order approach. Well, because someone ran experiments and found that after fifth order, things got worse. There's no really good justification why a fifth order was better than a fourth order, other than that's what worked. So after 32 hours of data, things are still, you know, are getting better. Why not continue? It does not cost us anything to collect this unsupervised data. Google's sitting on terabytes of this stuff now. So let's continue collecting the data until we see some bad effects due to the data. But this is encouraging because this means after 32 hours of data, things are still getting better using unsupervised training. Okay, is that clear? Because, I mean, that's the essential point here, is that we're getting some mileage out of unsupervised data. So in the next set of experiments, we ask the question, can we scale up this benefit by training, seeding with 1 hour and then training on 1 hour, 200 hours, 2,000 hours, and a modification of the 2,000 hours. And in fact, what you see is that we're able to go from 51% to 27%, and we're able to get essentially this improvement in performance by scaling up the amount of unsupervised training data. And this is pretty remarkable because this was all bootstrapped with 1 hour, only 1 hour of manually transcribed data. Now, another thing that was looked at was in table four was, does this in fact, how does the performance vary when we bootstrap from 10 hours instead of 1 hour? And at 10 hours of data, performance was not significantly better than at 1 hour of data. So if we look at this 2,000 plus INC row and we look at second, we see with 10 hours of data, we got 25.5% on the DEV04 test. And in the upper table with the 2,000 plus incremental, we got 27.0 for the same result. So those two numbers are pretty close. The obviously the number is a little bit better, but the difference between 27.0 and 25.5 does not justify using an order of magnitude more fully transcribed data to seed the system. Plus, if the performance increases are continue with the unsupervised data, we can recover this difference by just adding maybe another 2,000 hours of unsupervised data. So we see that the amount of seed data that we need is not so much of an issue. We can just start with 1 hour of seed data and use lots of unsupervised data. And we can also see that manually transcribing more data is not crucial for unsupervised training, that there seems to be a nice gradual increase in performance with the more and more unsupervised training that we're adding. So we can look at these results in terms of our metrics, the word error rate recovery and the word error rate ratio. If we look at the word error rate recovery, and we can look at that as a function of the amount of seed data, 1 hour versus 10 hours, and the amount of audio data, 32 hours, 200 hours, 2,000 hours, and this 2,000 plus inc. The 2,000 plus inc condition is described in the paper. I won't spend too much time on that because that's a little speech specific. But we can focus on these first three rows, the 32, 200, and 2,000. So the word error rate recovery metric goes from 59% to 71% to 80%. Now, that's pretty striking. Why? So So in going from 32 to 200, this represents how much of an increase in the amount of unsupervised training data. It's an order of magnitude, right? It's an order of magnitude, right? 2,000 divided, 2,000 roughly is an order of magnitude more than 32. What happened to the word error rate recovery metric? It went up by 10%, approximately, okay? Then we went from 2,000 from 200 to 2,000. That's another order of magnitude. And we recovered another 10%. Now, this did drop a little bit. You might say, well, this is actually like 12%, and this is like 9%, which means if we went to 20,000 hours of data, maybe we get 8%, 7%. That would bring us to like 88, close to 90% recovery. And then maybe if we go to 200,000 hours and so forth, maybe if we go to 1,000,000 hours, we could actually recover 100% of what we could recover with the supervised training. Now, again, remember, you're not going to have 2,000 hours of supervised training. But this seems to suggest that as we continue adding data in increments of an order of magnitude, we're going to get better. And we recognize that adding unsupervised data comes with very little cost, especially when you have an application like the Google phone that's generating large amounts of data on a daily basis. It does take a significant amount of compute time to process this data, but supercomputing clusters these days are not all that expensive, so this is feasible within today's computing resources. Now, to further verify that, we can look at this word error rate ratio. And what's interesting about that is you see the ratio is fairly constant across these three data sets. That means that's a good news story, because that means that we're still getting good mileage out of the next increment of data. This ratio is not changing. So that's another sort of verification that as we've increased the data, we're still learning useful things about the data. And it's very common to see these kinds of improvements in a logarithmic scale. That's pretty normal for data-driven type machine learning technology. We also see that the results hold across the two different evaluation sets. Both these measures are fairly similar across both data sets. So that might suggest that these measures are actually a good way to look at the results in a data independent way. And actually people are somewhat interested in that, because absolute error rates can fluctuate significantly from one domain to the next. But the feeling is that maybe these metrics will be somewhat constant across different domains. And then we also see that the what's interesting here is that the word error rate recovery for the increasing the amount of manual data is not necessarily increasing your word error rate recovery. So that's another sign that it's probably not necessary to manually transcribe large amounts of data. It's a much better strategy to just manually transcribe a small amount of data and use much larger amounts of unsupervised data. So the word error rate ratio may be more easily understood and better behaved. It appears to remain constant as the amount of data increases. Naturally, as the amount of initial transcribed data increases, this ratio will approach 1. The fact that this ratio keeps roughly constant for a given amount of initial training means that as the word error rate of the supervised training decreases with more training data, the absolute difference between unsupervised and supervised will decrease. And that's sort of the fundamental result of this paper, that's showing that if I had access to millions of hours of unsupervised data, I can probably approach or exceed performance of fully supervised data because I can always collect two or three or four orders of magnitude more unsupervised data than I can supervised data. So as we get access to more and more audio data, there is less motivation for manually transcribing the audio data. And I think this is an important result, and you know, again, I want to emphasize that I think this is a result which translates to many different domains, just not just speech recognition. The problem, though, is that in many domains, well, speech is one of the few domains where we have access to this amount of volume of data. If you're playing around with, you know, small data sets of hundreds or thousands of data points, you can't really do these kinds of experiments. So what this paper has done is to show that the amount of untranscribed audio data, as the amount of untranscribed audio data increases, unsupervised training continues to decrease the word error rate faster than supervised training. And supervised training with less manual data decreases the word error rate faster than bootstrapping with more data. That's actually an interesting observation that sometimes if you start with a really highly tuned system and you try then to apply it to a different data set, you have to spend some effort untuning the system, if you will. So sometimes it's better to start with a simple system. This is sort of the principle of Occam's razor. Start with a simple system trained on a small amount of data, and then let it learn what it needs to. Let it sort of evolve in a natural direction on the data, rather than trying to start with a more advanced system, which may be overtuned, and then having to kind of drag that system back to a more general state, and then let it train to its final state. So this is another sort. This is sort of consistent with Occam's razor that just start with a simple system and let it learn what it needs to learn, rather than trying to be a little more smart about the initial starting point, because the initial starting point may not be the right place for your to get to the final resting point. And again, that's because we tend to be in these multidimensional spaces with lots of local optimums. So the potential for getting stuck in a local optimum is high. The word error rate ratio seems to depend only on the initial amount of manual data and remains constant as more data is added. This characteristic implies that there is less motivation to manually transcribe more data if a great amount of audio data is available. And that's just another way of saying that we appear to be getting good mileage out of going from 200 hours to 2,000 hours. So it makes sense to then think about going beyond 2,000 hours. Now, again, we did not talk about the language modeling aspect of this, but it's generally been assumed that a good language model is key to success with unsupervised training data. The assumed mechanism for improvement is that the language model causes the system to recognize some of the training words that would not be recognized correctly with only the acoustic model. Language models are very important because they sort of serve like a parent. You know, when a child is learning how to speak and a child says something, the parent will say, no, that's not right, say it this way. And the child has gotten all this sort of the articulation of the sounds correct, but not gotten the overall grammar or semantics correct. Language models serve much the same way. They really force the system to hang together at a semantic level, and that's very important when you want to get high-performance speech recognition. You can actually train a system from scratch. If you have a really strong language model, you can learn the acoustics automatically, but the vice versa is not true. It's hard to learn the acoustics when you don't have a strong language model. So the LMs used in this study were considered powerful because they were trained on 1 billion words. And therefore, if you try to repeat this experiment in a scenario where you don't have a strong language model, you will not get as much mileage out of the unsupervised training process. The language model actually plays a key role here. And hence, while this is really good work, we have to put it in perspective that if I was going into a new language that I knew very little about, I would still need to spend time developing a good language model. And I should do that before I actually attempt to do the acoustic model training. Now that's, again, that's I don't think that's specific to speech. I think in any domain where you're using a what used to be called semantic pattern recognition, where you're using a knowledge component on top of your spectral or your acoustic modeling component, the knowledge component needs to be built ahead of time because that's going to really guide the training process. Now the good news is the knowledge component in applications like language can be built from information already available on the internet, for example, text and stuff. So we can get at that for almost any language. Well, not, we can get at that more easily. Now the interesting thing is, in some languages we can't get at that because some languages do not have written forms. Some languages are only spoken. Some languages are not really well captured on the internet. I can, you know, give it, when you look at the world's languages, maybe 150 of them appear on the internet in various forms. But there's, you know, the vast majority of languages do not have a lot of data out on the internet. So building a language model still represents a challenge, but we'll sort of ignore that because that's really more specific to the hierarchical pattern recognition problem. Okay, so I think with that, actually the authors have begun to look at performance with weak language models, and they cite similar trends for weaker language models, but I expect that work will be published at the next major conference, so we can follow up on that. So the point today is that you can use adaptation to get higher performance systems, and you can do that adaptation in an unsupervised way and actually get good performance if you have access to large amounts of data. Okay. So on Tuesday, we'll do our last lecture, and then we'll see our Radiance colleagues on a week and a half from today. And they'll show us their beamforming system. Okay. See you on Tuesday.